Hey everyone, this amazing ESO Network show is brought to you by our fine sponsor, Amazon.com. Please remember to shop Amazon for all your geeky needs, no matter what time of the year it is. All you need to do is go to ESOpodcast.com/ESOAmazon or click on the Amazon banner on the ESO Network webpage to go to our e-store. It's the best way to shop and the best way to support this program, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. Okay, that's enough of me babbling for now. Now on with your regular scheduled show.
Welcome to Earth Station One, a weekly podcast dedicated to all things sci-fi, fantasy, and much, much more. Sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Earth Station One podcast. That's right, folks. We are here for our next installment of the ESO Book Club. And this time out, we are looking at Mouse by Art Spiegelman. An interesting storyline, an interesting book, and not one of those quick reads either. And we have a great crew to talk all about it this week. But speaking of great crews, right back from South Carolina, we have Mr. Mike Gordon.
Howdy.
How are you, my friend?
I am fine. I've still got that one day coming back from a convention kind of almost hangover, like, you know, feel a little dehydrated. The voice isn't quite there yet, but we'll talk about it later. But we had such a good time in South Carolina. Again, we can't thank Robert and Michelle enough for having us out there, and the people of the convention and the people of Greenville. It's just a great show. So thank you for that. And So we're heading right from that into talking about Mouse. So it's going to be pretty intense and interesting, but this is an impressive and important book. So I think I'm glad that we're covering it here on the show.
Oh yeah, it's a great topic I've wanted to do for years, and having the book club now, it was almost perfect to do. You know, it's just, you know, for people who think a funny animal book, this is not that. Mouse is not about Mickey. It's not about, you know, something that, you know, Tom and Jerry or anything. It is a serious book about, you know, World War II and people who went through the Holocaust. And it's a topic that deserves the respect. And it is not a trade paperback that I would ever, and I do mean ever, recommend reading late at night right before you fall asleep. I made that mistake this last weekend.
And, as did I.
And so, you know, we definitely want to hear from you guys at home. You know, please write us esopodcast@gmail.com. We definitely want to hear from you guys. Did you read the book along with us, or have you read the book? We want to hear, you know, what you guys' thoughts on it.
If you haven't read the book, we are going to spoil it. I will just say that.
Oh,
so yeah, I would recommend people read the book, but obviously, if they don't care about spoilers, we will be going in depth.
Exactly. And it is a 25-year-old book, actually older than that now. And also it talks about an event that happened over 70 years ago. So if you need to be spoiled with what happened, you know, maybe this is not the episode for you to listen to. But if we did see you at Greenville this last weekend at the SC Comic Con, howdy. Welcome to the show. Very glad to have you here for the first time. So definitely, you know, this is going to be a neat experience to talk about this week. And we might as well get started with both feet. Let's get into rants and raves. Let's find out what's on our mind. Mike, you're up first.
Well, real quick, I do want to mention that I'm very, very, very excited that a longtime friend that I never thought I'd see again is back on TV, and that is Samurai Jack. I was a big Samurai Jack fan, like a lot of people, on Cartoon Network back in the day. And I really, once it was over, I never thought I'd see that show again. And not only is it back, but it's better than it. I'll say it. It's better than it ever was. They've definitely. It's now on Adult Swim. It's still on Cartoon Network, but it's now on Adult Swim, and it is very much an adult show. And they didn't just up the violence, though. They have been dealing with the fact that story wise, that it's more intense and that it's more adult now. That some time has passed since the last episode of this aired, and it's just done really well. And I just want to give Cartoon Network and all the sponsors big props for having faith in this series to bring it back. I think that, like I said, I never expected to see it again. I want to thank Getty Tarkovsky for coming back and being part of it again. I mean, he was the creator of the show, and he is back in a big way with this final season. It's supposed to be the final season, so we'll see. I'll be curious to see what they do with it. But it's so good. It's one of the best things, easily one of the best things I'm watching on TV right now.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. I thought when it series ended years ago, they actually wrapped it up.
No, they didn't wrap it up. I mean, they kind of not in a way that was satisfying to anybody who was watching it. So, yeah, it was one that could have definitely continued. I don't feel like it had a definite ending, because they always kind of talked about finishing the story. Even 10 years ago, they were talking about finishing the story, because it's been a long time since the show first premiered in 2001. It went to 2004, and that was it. Like, we thought that was it. That's done. So here it is, you know, over 10 years later, and we're getting new episodes. But again, it's pretty much been made clear by Getty that it'll be its fifth. This season will be its last. They just want to finish the story. So, and that's fair. It's going to be interesting, though, from a perspective of, like, if you buy the Ultimate Series box set, eventually, you know, you're going to be watching it, and the first, you know, four seasons are going to be like, oh, this is kind of cute. That's kind of cool. Visually really interesting. And then all of a sudden the fifth season are going to be like, holy crap, this is intense. Like, this is, yeah, it, like, things get, like, real serious in the fifth. But it still has that visual style, and it still has its goofy moments. Episode two, no spoilers, but episode two starts off really goofy and gets really serious. So, it's just a great series, and I'm glad. I didn't realize how much I missed it until now that it's back. I'm like, wow, this is definitely going up there as one of my favorite shows, maybe of all time.
Wow. That's pretty amazing to say.
Yeah. Cool. Especially when it competes with on the same channel, you know, well, not on the same channel, but actually, you know, Rebels is going on now too. And that's been pretty amazing. I haven't watched the last episode or the last couple of episodes since we were in, at the convention this weekend, but I'm that's right there up there as one of my favorite series too.
Mm-hmm. I'm a few weeks behind on Rebels, but it's been amazing this season, and I like everything they're going for. And it's gonna be interesting if they do tie it into Rogue One, you know, eventually.
So it should be cool. There's a little bit of leeway there, so we'll see what they do.
Exactly. So it should be cool. Yeah, it's funny because this leads into mine. Remember a couple weeks back, we were talking about, you know, cable systems and, hey, I'm ready to cut the cord, or I'm going to move from Comcast and, you know, should I go to the Dish? Should I go to AT&T? Should I just, you know, give it all up and, you know, just stream everything? So, of course, you know, we got some great feedback from a few folks out there. Thank you so much for the people who gave me advice and everything. And we had decided that we were going to go with the Dish. Well, it got to the point where, you know, we contacted Comcast and they were like, oh, we'd hate to leave you. You leave us, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, we had decided that we were going to get the Dish. And AT&T had horrible speeds in our area for internet, so we were going to stay with Comcast for our internet speed. So we got to the day when they were going to come and install the Dish, and the guy installer came, looked around, and had this device in his hand and said, so sorry, we can't install the Dish here. And I said, why not? Other neighbors have the Dish, you know, it's not a problem. He says, you have too many trees around here. He's like, excuse me? He's like, yeah, you have too many trees. You can't get a clear signal. And we don't, if you don't have like at least a 90% signal strength, we are not going to install a Dish here. So that basically knocked us out of the ballpark there because we couldn't, you know, we were like, oh, so what are we going to do? We don't want to stick with Comcast because they've always, you know, messed us up some way or another. And so we called AT&T and said, hey, how much is it for UVerse? We were supposed to get the dish, blah, blah, blah. And this is what happened. And they said, oh, we can come in and do, you know, bring it in, put in four boxes, one on each TV you have in the house. And, you know, we'll do it for this amount of price. And we were like, okay, come on, do it. You know, let's get it done. And so we called Comcast the day before AT&T was supposed to come out and say, hey, we're canceling service as of tomorrow. And they were like, why? And it's like, why don't we explain the story? And it's like, we don't want to pay, you know, in all honesty, Comcast was raising our bill $60 a month just to keep the same service that we've had for the past 2 years. And so I told him the story, and the woman at Comcast was like, well, let me tell you what I can do for you. And it's like, why didn't you do this for me before? She says, well, you know, now it's, you know, the final, like, this is the bottom of the ninth inning for us, you know, that type of, you know, scenario. And basically, she told us that she was going to double our internet speed to like 150, and they were going to give us all the channels we had, but they were also going to throw in HBO, Showtime, Stars, and I think Cinemax for $1 a month for the whole contract. And so basically we were paying $20 more and we got an extra box. So we had two boxes in the house. And so that way, you know, we had DVR now in two places, and we canceled AT&T, you know, said, hey, don't bother coming out. We're going to stick with Comcast. So after all the rigmarole and everything, you know, we stayed with Comcast. And now here's the kicker, folks. I don't think I've turned on the TV once since I've gotten cable back. We've just been so busy with everything that's happened with the podcasts and then also with the website crashing. I just haven't had time to catch up on any of the TV shows. I'd hate to see how full my DVR is now because I haven't seen Flash. I haven't seen Arrow. I haven't seen Walking Dead. I haven't seen Legends of Tomorrow. I haven't watched Rebels. Judy has to finish up This Is Us, which is supposed to be an amazing show. And, you know, it's like, we just haven't had the time. And it's like, hopefully things will slow down maybe in 2018. So we'll have to wait and see. But I just wanted to give you the update of saga of the cable system in our house. How's that for a rant and rave? And so, awesome. Exactly. So it's pretty cool. So thank you again for everyone who did give us the advice. We did appreciate it. And we would have stuck with the dish because it just intrigued me that, you know, not having to worry about paying Comcast anymore. But that just didn't go our way. So we are with them for the next 2 years. Yay. Woohoo. And then probably we'll cut the cord completely because by then, you know, everything will be, you know, a la carte or whatever. So, you know, we definitely want to hear from you guys at home. Please let us know what you guys got going on in your world. We definitely want to hear from you. Has anyone seen the new Power Rangers movie? Kind of curious about that one. So check it out. And we are going to take a break and we'll be back in a moment.
Hi, this is Ashley Pauls with this week's What to Watch. We've had a really big month at the box office so far, with several major releases pulling in summer blockbuster type dollars. So it's been pretty exciting to see and kind of get people pumped up extra early for summer blockbuster season. Beauty and the Beast topped the box office once again, but Power Rangers actually wasn't as much of a flop as some people thought it was going to be. So it looks like despite poor reviews, nostalgia did play a role. And we've got several new challengers for box office champion this week. First up, we've got Ghost in the Shell, which stars Scarlett Johansson as a cyber-enhanced human who's been designed as a weapon to take on dangerous criminals. Of course, in the middle of this action, she's also trying to unlock the secrets to her past and the life that was stolen from her. This one is, of course, based on the Japanese manga of the same name. I've been having a bit of a hard time getting a read on this one. I haven't seen any critical reviews yet, And of course, we also had some controversy surrounding Scarlet's casting, especially from fans of the original manga. But I'm curious to see how this one performs at the box office this weekend and what the initial reviews are like. Next up, we've got The Boss Baby, which is an animated film with a bit of an unusual premise. Not quite sure how to describe it other than that Alec Baldwin voices a baby who wears a suit, speaks like an adult, and acts like a cutthroat corporate leader. And his plan is basically to make sure babies are more appreciated by society. Anyway, this one looks a little bit strange, but who knows? At least they get some points for originality, right? Finally, we have The Zookeeper's Wife, which is based on a true story about a woman living in World War II Poland who helps run a zoo. And then after Nazi Germany invades her country, she secretly joins the resistance. This story that it's based on looks really cool, and I'd actually like to learn more about the history behind it. This movie seems like one of those prestige kind of Academy Awards pictures, so it's perhaps a little bit telling that we're getting this movie in March instead of late fall, early winter, when Academy Awards-type films are typically released. And it sounds like critics are saying that it's not executed as well as it could have been, which again is a shame because it sounds like a really cool true story. Out on DVD this week, we have Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. While I didn't love this movie quite as much as some of the other movies in the Harry Potter franchise, it's still a very charming, magical film with lots of cool creatures and a completely different take on the Harry Potter universe. So if you didn't get a chance to see this in theaters, please definitely rent this one on DVD. Also on DVD, we have the comedy Why Him, starring Bryan Cranston and James Franco. James Franco plays a guy who's dating Bryan Cranston's daughter. Bryan Cranston is not impressed. This one didn't really do a whole lot to rewrite the comedy genre, but might be worth a couple bucks for a laugh. Well, that's it for this week. We actually don't have a lot of big blockbusters coming up in the week after this, but next time we'll go ahead and talk about some smaller films that may still be worth your time to check out in theaters. You know the nearest destination,
oh, you slip sliding away. We need to tape a promo, guys. If you had to encapsulate the roundtable in one catchphrasey kind of way, what would you say?
Rampant dickery? Or donkulous? let's not go with Shrek. That you know. The okay. First one was good. The second one was great. After that, it kind of, you know.
Guys, promo. Stay on topic here. Yeah. Stay on topic.
Stay on topic. Oh, no, I'm going in.
Stay on topic.
Red leader, I'm sorry. Stay on topic. I can't shake it. It's up to you, Red 5.
Oh, God.
Where's the promo,
so,
Luke?
Promo! The Roundtable, brought to you by Revolution SF. Tough love for sci-fi. Available at revolutionsf.com and iTunes.
All right.
Absolutely. I have stories, millions of them.
Well, that's good. Well, that's why we're recording
and
already.
Pictures to go with them. Yeah.
Hey, the pictures always count because, uh-huh. You know, for those people who don't know how to read, it's awesome.
That was before.
I know. Well,
that was before there were cell phones.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
And they used to actually have to take pictures with film. Ugh, wow.
Ooh. I remember when cameras came out and cell phones, like, I'm never going to use this feature. I don't need that. But true geeks know that you do.
Oh, of course. Well, we're already recording, so we might as well just go into the segment.
Yeah. All right. So this,
let's do it.
So this will be 20 minutes. We got to wrap it up at 9. So, so let's go.
Okay. We are here with Suzanne Perry, and let's welcome her to the show. Hey, Suzanne.
Hey, Mike and Mike.
Exactly.
Howdy.
Glad to be here.
And we are glad to have you. Welcome to the station. For those people who may not be familiar with you, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, my. Well, let's see. I'll do it pertaining to Tura Sultana, because that's basically what we're going to be talking about. I was Tura's manager. I met her in 99. Very funny story. I met her in 99 at a show and then worked with her in 2000. And I remember getting home, and she was driving back and forth to Reno then. And I got a phone call, I think, that night or the next day, and it was Tura. And she just said, hi, this is Tura Sultana, and I've made up my mind you're going to be my manager. okay. There was no no. There was no negotiation. That was it. And so I worked with her for years, and we started Tura Sultana Productions together, and we started doing her film together. And when she passed, she died on my birthday, which isn't a bad thing. It was almost a publicity move for her. It was pretty awesome, actually, and it's carried with me. So now I've got the whole ship. So I'm doing everything, and one of the promises I made to Tura was I will finish this film. And I wear her ashes around my neck, so I know that if I don't, it's not going to be pretty for me.
And by this film, you mean, of course, the documentary that you're working
yes,
on right
sorry,
now.
Yes, sorry, yes.
Which is,
so
of course.
So basically what it's called Tura, !, all caps, the documentary. And it's based on her book, her memoirs that she wrote, The Kick-Ass Life of Tura Sultana. And Cody Jarrett, one of my dear friends and one of Tura's dear friends and the director of Sugarbox, is directing. And we have got the people from Yum Yum F behind us, the Yum Yum F Foundation. No, it's actually not a foundation. It is just Yum Yum F Network. There we go. Told you my brain is sizzled. And we are starting a Kickstarter. We started 2 weeks ago, and we have a Kickstarter going on now. And we're trying to get everybody to get involved. A lot of people still don't even know we're doing this, which is just beyond my brain capacity. But I think it's going to be great. But in the past, I guess you were asking me a question, and I just ran over it. I've done management. I'm a design, graphic design person. I do website design and every kind of design with Girlworks Media is my company. And I just started doing management and photography, and I kind of wear several different hats. So I've worked with a lot of celebrities. I've managed all the Russ Meyer people, and I helped produce Beyond the Valley of the Dolls on DVD. I got it on DVD for the very first time.
Nice. And excellent.
Wow. Yeah. And then toured with the cast and all of that stuff. So I'm kind of a Russ Meyer geek and a cult movie geek and television geek, tiki geek. That's me.
Let's get right into the documentary.
Please.
For those people who may not know who Tura Sultana mm-hmm. is, tell us why who she was and why she is worthy of a documentary.
Right. She was, I guess, best known for her role in Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. Everybody knows her from that. Varla, the long hair, the bangs, the black outfit. Her and Haji and Laurie Williams out in the desert, three women. The movie was basically their film. It was a movie that made women fearful, fearless, and men feared them. And she also was a very famous burlesque dancer and performer. She went by the name Miss Japan Beautiful. And that's how she started out, was dancing. And she was also in Irma La Douce. She was Shirley MacLaine's sidekick in Irma La Douce. She's done a lot of films and TV, but she's mostly known for Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. And she is... Wow, she's a jumble of, she's Asian, American, Indian, and back then, there weren't any women that were even doing this kind of role. She was a black belt in Aikido, and she also did all her own stunts, all of them. So when you see her on screen, that's her.
She's unmistakable on screen, so I can't even yes. imagine somebody trying to fill in for her.
No.
And that's it. And because of that film, in particular, but she is, yes, a very striking, iconic figure in and of herself.
Absolutely. She was a role model for women. And still to this day, I mean, especially since we've been doing the campaign and we're really putting ourselves out there, we get letters every day from women that she's inspired. And it's just, it brings tears to your eyes to read these stories of how her performance and her attitude has made other women learn how to stand up for themselves and not be afraid to. When she was, I think, 9, 10 years old, she was raped by 5 men. And she was sent to reform school because of that, because back then it was like, oh, it was her fault. Well, she kind of matured a little early, and she ended up getting back at all of those men. And the story is in this film, and it's phenomenal. She has inspired so many women. She inspired John Waters. And there's a great story in the film about John Waters and Divine going to see Faster Pussycat at the drive-in over and over and over. And that's how he actually patterned Divine after Tura, how she screams and yells all her lines. And that's he used her as an example. So many people and so many films. I mean, Rob Zombie, Quentin Tarantino has paid homage to Tura in most of his Kill Bill films. If you'll notice in one scene, there's a woman in the back seat wearing a Tura Sutana t-shirt. Very subtle, but it's there. And Pee Wee Herman just did his last film, and he did an homage by having the three women, and Tura was one of them, played by another actress, of course, but they were throughout the film. So she's inspired women, but she and directors and films and burlesque dancers. I mean, it's endless. And she has a story, and the story, you know, for her to go through what she went through and come out of this and turn it all around into a positive and become a superstar in the cult movie era, in the genre rather. It's pretty amazing. And most people don't know the story. And we're giving little hints here and there, but the doc, there's so many people on board with our documentary. It's and coming at us every day.
And
it's really,
yeah,
really something.
And let's talk about some of those people. You've got some really, heavy hitters that are part of this. You mentioned already John Waters, but yes, some other people who contribute to interviews as well.
Absolutely. Margaret Cho is narrating. She stepped on immediately. John Waters stepped on before we could even finish getting it out of our mouths. He says, I'm in. Dita Von Teese. Today we're doing a special. She just did a wonderful pitch for us, and we've got that video on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You just go and find Tura Sutana Productions, and you'll see the video. We've got Kitten Natividad, of course. We've got Shannon Lee, Bruce Lee's daughter. We've got Eric Charmello. We've got Carmen Electra. I'm running out of people. Pamela DeBar, Allison Anders, the director. A lot of people that we're saving. Elvira is one of them. We've got people coming at us saying, I want to be a part of this. So when we kind of ran out of money, because this is a passion play. This is me and Cody going in here and doing it ourselves. And we've got an amazing DP behind us. We've got a lot of strength behind us. We just need the money to finish this film. And it's so important. And we're working so hard. We just need the funds to come in to finish it and get it out to the world. Because it's amazing. We just did an event in San Francisco with the Alamo Draft House and CamFest. And we sold out the theater for Faster Pussycat. And they were astonished. I mean, that was the first Weird Wednesday they had that actually sold out.
Wow.
So there's an audience for it. We just have to stir it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And it looks like there's, as people are listening to this, there's less than 2 weeks to go. So please, we encourage everybody to jump on this. We're going to have a link to the Kickstarter, right to the Kickstarter campaign in the show notes. So all you have to do is click there and look at and check out all the ways that you can pledge. And definitely, it's worth a look-see. Before we let you go,
our perk list, don't forget the perk list. We've got perks that you can't get anywhere. Tura Sutana fans, geek cult movie fans are going to go nuts when they go in and look at our perks. So you can choose your own category to pledge in. And these are one-of-a-kind items that are never going to be given out again. Just saying.
Great. No, absolutely. And definitely check that out. So, before we let you go, we've got a chair here, the geek seat, and it gets hungry. It gets hungry for victims, and I only regret that Tura couldn't be here because, man, she would eat that seat alive.
You better believe it. Maybe I can just channel her a little bit.
So Mike, if you'll do the honors.
Of course I will, Mr. Mike. Tie her up.
See, I sneak it in while I'm asking the question, so they're secure now. By the time I hand it to you, Mike, they're secure.
They're secure, right. but how secure are you about this? So it's okay.
No. Exactly.
All right, your first question in the geek seat. What was your favorite geek out moment?
Oh, boy, I have to pick one.
Just one for right now.
Probably when Tura called and told me I was going to be her manager.
That is awesome.
That's pretty much top of the list.
I'm totally. You're probably wow.
And I like the fact that she just called up and said, "You're my manager."
Oh, and it was just like that. It was kind of like, okay. And then she said, "I'm sending you some stuff," and she did lots of it. So it's kind of like a crazy person's museum in here.
Wow.
It's pretty great.
That might lead into your other question then. What was your most disappointing geek out moment?
Oh, wow. Eek. Probably, let's see. I don't want to get in trouble here. I'm having a little stump. I'm stumped with that one, even when I read it. Gosh, it would probably be meeting somebody I really wanted to meet and find out they were just... So it's, horrible. And I really don't want to say because they're not dead yet. And just having it go, are you serious? And it's kind of like that big disappointment. Maybe you really don't want to meet the people that are on your high list because they're just people. Meet them on a bad day and it ruins your whole image.
Oh, I'm sure. We've had that quite a bit. We've actually been, fortunate to have experienced that ourselves. What geeks you out the most?
Yes. Pardon me?
What geeks you out the most?
Oh, gosh. Eek. Finding fabulous things in a thrift store or a flea market. Going in and just finding that one thing that you never thought you'd find. And it's just, it just makes your whole world.
Oh, sure.
Or you never even knew existed.
Yeah. It's just finding that one thing that you have to brush the dust off of and just how do I fit this in the car? And that would be it. That's my total high.
No, totally makes sense. What turns your geek off?
Horribly rude people. Again, same thing. Like if I'm working with somebody or if I'm, working on a film or working whatever in at whatever way, and there's a celebrity that I've geeked out on maybe, and they come into the picture and I find out, ooh, asshole. Can you say that on podcasts? I think you can. That would just be like, really, no room for that.
No, understand that completely. We understand that when you find out that. What fictional character would you like to meet the most?
Fictional character, egads. Oh, wow. I used to think Fred Flintstone, but I think I might want to leave it. I don't know why. I'll just leave it at that because that's something about, there you go.
That's awesome.
Completely insane. She's insane. Of course
I am. Yabba dabba doo.
Yeah.
Exactly. What fictional character would you not like to meet?
Eek, any of the villains in the Disney films.
Ooh, that's good, actually. That is a really
good
one.
Just don't want to have to deal with that. They can blow you up and change you into things. Too much trouble getting back.
Mm-hmm.
I'll sidestep that, yeah.
Okay.
No villains.
Yeah, there you go. What is your favorite geek word, phrase, quote, or pose?
Oh, it's my happening and it freaks me out.
Okay. I like that.
From Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
No, I
know. You'll know that.
Of course.
Just for those people that are like, what? Yeah.
Yeah, if they're under a certain age, they'll be like, what the heck is that?
What's wrong with her? Yeah.
What is your ideal geek occupation?
The one I have.
Number one answer.
Really? It couldn't be better than this. Yeah.
That's
photographing
all.
From photographing Cynthia Myers to touring with all the cast members of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls to working with Tura Sitana to doing this film. It's pretty much I'm in geek heaven.
What geek occupation would you not like to do?
I I don't know if it's a geek occupation, but probably answering the phones and doing something that doesn't let your personality come through.
Nope. Understandable.
That makes sense?
Oh, yeah, of course.
All right.
No, totally understand that. Are you ready for your final question in the geek seat, Stephanie?
Yes.
What is your ultimate geek fantasy?
Wow. To probably get this, I know, no, it is not probably, to get Tura's film made and hear all the stories from everyone that she's inspired and go to the next level and make the actual narrative film.
Wow. That is a great fantasy.
That would be impressive.
And it might come true if you guys help her Kickstarter.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Get in there. Look at the perks.
Exactly.
Anything. And push it out to social media. People that, you know, say, I don't have any money, I can't give. Even a dollar helps. But what helps if you don't have money is just push it out on Twitter and social media. Tell your friends. Get in everybody's face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that helps a lot.
Nope. Totally understand that.
Well,
you have made it through the geek seat. Mr. Mike, tell the young lady what she won.
You have won a lifetime subscription to the ESO Network, a value easily worth... I'm sorry, it's not going to help with the Kickstarter, but it's like $6.
All right. That's pretty good. I'll take it. Jeez. All right.
But it's been a real treat having you on, and we wish you the best of luck. I think, you know, I mean... Obviously, you know, when we have people on, we really hear a lot of their stories about doing their passion projects with Kickstarter. So we never want them to fail. So anything that our listeners can do to help you out and make this happen, because I think this really needs to happen.
It does.
So
absolutely. And so many people have said that already, like this movie has to be made.
So we'll definitely have a link on the show notes for the right that goes right to the Kickstarter. Is there any other links that you want to let people know about online?
There's the Tura Sultana Productions website, which is of course turasultanaproductions.com. You can see other things there. You can see a lot of clips there. You can read about who I am, and turasultana.com is her site that I've kept going, and it was her site that I built with her. Pretty much that's it.
Awesome. Well, we will have both of those show
links. Most important. Very good.
We will have both those links on our show notes. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys. Thanks for the support. And I want to see those stats go up.
Absolutely.
Get on it. Just do it, as Tura would say. Just do it.
Our 10 listeners will be right there. Don't worry.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Michelle, and this is the Iconic Rock Talk Show Moment. The lineup of presenters for this year's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony have all been announced, and they are Neil Young, who will be inducting Pearl Jam, Jackson Browne will do the honors for Joan Baez, George Harrison's son Donnie will induct ELO, Rush will be presenting for Yes, Patrick Monahan from Train will be honoring Journey, Snoop Dogg will induct his friend Tupac Shakur, and Pharrell will present the Ahmet Erdogan Award for Musical Excellence to Nile Rodgers. Also, Lenny Kravitz will perform a tribute to Prince, and other scheduled performers include Alicia Keys, the Indigo Girls, and Mary Chapin Carpenter. The ceremony is April 7th at the Barclays Center in New York, and it will be broadcast on HBO starting April 29th. The inductee exhibit opens this Friday at the museum in Cleveland, and it will be running for several months. The hall has previewed some of the items in the exhibit. There's a red grand piano used by Journey's Jonathan Cain on all the tours and concert videos from the 80s up through 2007. There's also a gold top Les Paul Standard played by Jeff Lynne of ELO circa 1974. And Eddie Vedder's t-shirt with a K drawn in black marker over the heart that he wore when Pearl Jam appeared on Saturday Night Live 2 weeks after the death of Vedder's friend Kurt Cobain. You may remember Queen's album from 1980 called The Game. That's the one that gave us Crazy Little Thing Called Love. Well, now there's actually a Queen game. Hasbro's immortalized the band with its very own signature edition of Monopoly. This version of Monopoly is a little bit different. Instead of buying railroads and apartment buildings, with this one you follow the Queen story as you go around the board. And along the way, you get to buy some of these world-famous concert venues where Queen played, and you can rent them out. That sounds way more fun than railroads and utilities, if you ask me. Of course, it's got custom playing pieces. There's a Brian May Red Special guitar. A woman on a bicycle. Couldn't tell from the press photo if she was dressed or not. Stewie Griffin's nemesis, the robot monster. A hammer, an old-fashioned radio, and a vacuum cleaner. Queen fans know the significance of the vacuum cleaner. That game should be on the shelves starting in May. This has been the Iconic Rock Talk Show moment. Check out the blog at iconicrocktalkshow.wordpress.com. The most recent entry is a wrap-up of the Deep River Music Vault playlist with songs by Journey, Hindu Love Gods, and Backdoor Slam.
Hey everyone, welcome to the next installment of the ESO Book Club, and we have a great crew to talk all about it. Let's welcome from Earth Station Who, the lovely Mary Ogle.
Hi everybody, it's great to be here.
Yeah, we're not even talking Doctor Who this week.
Yeah, I don't know if I can handle it, but I'm going to try.
Oh, I know. It's going to be an interesting one this week, and returning to us is Tara Newman. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Well, you're on a book club podcast, so it's only appropriate that you're on for our book club segment.
I felt like it was a really nice fit.
Exactly.
Personally.
Well, it's interesting because we're talking about Mouse by Art Spiegelman, and this one is going to be a kind of a heavy episode to talk about. And it's not a happy-go-lucky, you know, graphic novel or even, you know, action wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, superhero type stuff. You know, last time we talked about Sandman, and this time we're going even heavier than Neil Gaiman's work.
And well, and the big difference is, I mean, with Sandman, it's pretty, I mean, well, the storyline that we talked about was pretty intense and violent, but it was, you know, fictional.
Well, right. Exactly.
Right.
Because this is all based off of the stories that Art Spiegelman's dad told him about his experiences in the Holocaust, and even, you know, pre-Holocaust, it actually set the groundwork for, you know, pre-World War II Poland. And it was just amazing to see.
Well, I think it's a very appropriate time to talk about it because the world is probably closer to fascism than we've been in a long time. That's not just the U.S., yeah, but not just the U.S., also across Europe.
Exactly. So, it's not just, you know, we're not trying to get into political, you know, what's currently going on, but it kind of ties in together.
Yeah, well, you can't help but talk about it because, I mean, that's what, you know, the whole reason that something like this exists is to make sure that we don't forget that these things can happen.
No, exactly. And that's the scary part about it is, you know, it happened once, it could happen again, folks. And reading this story and seeing what happened, you know, to the millions of people across Europe, it's just horrifying. And, you know, this is from the Jewish perspective, but it just wasn't what happened to the Jews. It was also to the gypsies, to the non-Christians, to the homosexuals, to, you know, so many different groups that were hit with this. In, you know, seeing this, you know, and, you know, many people out there know, you know, I am Jewish, and yes, we did lose family members to this, so it is kind of personal, and we've seen the stories. We have relatives, you know, who still have the numbers on their, you know, forearms, and, you know, it's, you know, nothing that, you know, should ever happen to anybody, ever. And to, you know, we've got to learn about it. And the sad thing is that generation's now completely dying off. This is, you know, they're getting right towards the end of it. And once they're gone, are people going to remember? And something like this will help that happen.
That's one of the ways I think this, the format of this book really works, because it's not just a story of the Holocaust, but it's a story of him discovering, of a son discovering what his father went through and coming to an understanding of how that made him the person he was and how that affected his son. It's a very personal book.
It's a unique and very personal perspective. And they say several times in the book, you know, they talk about other survivors and how other survivors aren't like this, but you know, there is no one way to survive something like this. There's no one way to deal with what these people went through. And I like that they do keep bringing that up throughout the book, but that this isn't, like you said, it's just an extremely personal take.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just not a story, though, about the Holocaust. It's also a story between a father and son and their relationship.
And a story between a husband and wife. I mean, you could argue this is The Notebook before The Notebook was created.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, actually. And it's just interesting to see how Spiegelman, you know, took these stories and experiences with his father, and instead of, you know, writing a novel about it, he took the medium that he wanted to, and he started, you know, doing it at first as a strip for a magazine. And, you know, he did a test run of it back in the 70s and then started with Raw Magazine in 1980 and doing Mouse there.
What's interesting is that I found interesting doing some backstory research, and I have to give a shout out actually to Peter Cutler, artist Peter Cutler, because he's a big fan of Spiegelman. And we talked a lot this weekend about it too. And apparently when he was editing Raw magazine, he wanted to do something serialized. And his first idea was to, because it was very relevant at the time, to do something about the Black experience, about racism that way. And he just, you know, he tried several times to get his head around it, but he just ultimately said, this is not my story to tell. And so when he finally, you know, realized my story to tell is one that of, you know, mine and my father's, then that's when it became clear that, you know, that's when Mouse was really born. Now, of course, there was the early strip that he did in the 70s, which is much more Spiegelman's traditional style, which is very detailed. I find interesting as the story itself, I find the style of which Spiegelman does this graphic novel very interesting. I mean, obviously all the races are different animals. But they're not animals per se. They're people with animal heads. and that's an interesting choice as well. And yet, you know, like I said, most of his cartoon work was very, very detail oriented, very intricate. If he had done Mouse that way, he'd still be working on the first volume right now, because it would just take him. It took him so long, but he just really keeps it so simple and basic. I mean, the faces don't even have. I mean, it's amazing how much emotion he's able to convey with just simple, basic dots for eyes faces.
Well, the graphic style is very, it's brutal. These are not lyrical line drawings. They're short and sharp and harsh. And you can almost feel his pen ripping into the paper because he's angry.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't shy away from that.
No, not at all.
And yeah, it's one, I think it's another thing that makes the format of this book so fantastic, is that you really feel the anger and the horror of what's going on.
It's also kind of interesting because, like how Mike mentioned earlier, the faces are the different animals, but they're in human form. But there's even times where you see them wearing masks almost. You could see the strings behind their holding the masks on.
Right, well, where the Jews are pretending to be Polish or the Jews are pretending to be German. Yeah. They have the masks identifying them as those different nationalities.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And I think also the fact that it's so simplistic in style makes it easier for readers to identify more with them, because the more detailed the faces are, the more the reader's going to distance themselves and say, well, that's not me, mm-hmm. you know? And then obviously you have the, you know, I mean, most of us out here have sort of compassion for animals. So you have that sort of going for this as well. And you have there are certain characteristics, human characteristics that are that seem to be stereotyped to animals. So, you know, art works with those as well. And he plays off a lot of different things. I mean, this is not just an account of what happened during the Holocaust. I mean, there's a lot. This is so deep in terms of a lot of things that are going on here.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And I think that was some of the reasons why the art style is so simplistic, is because you don't, if the depth is in the story, and in like the little moments.
Oh yeah. But if you look at the backgrounds and stuff and the clothing and everything, how he caught the era was just amazing.
Like, yeah, I would say actually there's still a lot of detail here, but it's just represented in a different way.
Yeah.
I guess maybe not detail, maybe just not. I'm about to say something mean about Neil Gaiman, and I don't mean this to be mean, but not busy for busy's sake. Neil Gaiman, I don't think is busy for busy's sake, but if you compare the art styles, which is almost impossible to do here, but if you compare the art styles and just the, it's not that there's not a lot on the page. There's a lot of page when you read Mouse. I just think it is a much, what is there, what needs to be there is there. There's not a lot of fluff.
I agree with you. He's cut it down to the core.
Oh, exactly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even the early chapters when there's the father's talking about, you know, how he met his mother and how, you know, he was what they called him, I think, what is it, the Don Juan or something.
And they compare him to some sort of movie star.
Yes. Yeah. Right. And, you know, basically, you know, he was all this. He was a salesman, but he was a single salesman in Poland, and he was, you know, a ladies' man, and, you know, he had this one woman flaunting all over him, and then he met the woman who was going to become Spiegelman's mother, and it was just, you know, the whole story was just amazing, you know, how they went through that, and the detail and the feeling, and then how he got drafted into the Polish army, and showing how the Jews were even then segregated against mm-hmm. the Polish soldiers, you know, when they got caught by the Germans and, you know, when the Germans started invading into Poland and how the Germans were in tents, you know, putting the Jews into the tents and the Polish soldiers got into cabins where it was heated and everything. It was just amazing, the storyline there.
And he keeps it very realistic and human in the sense that he doesn't gloss over the characters in it. I mean, his father is not portrayed as a saint or a martyr, and neither is he. I mean, Spiegelman actually, he kind of portrays himself as going into this with a chip on his shoulder. He's kind of self-centered and angry at the perceived mistreatment by his father and at his mother for abandoning him, or how he sees it as abandoning him. And he does not shy away from portraying that. But he does, I mean, Vladek is not, I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce his name. Spiegelman's father is not he's not a saint, but he's a consummate survivor.
You know, it's interesting though, because you even see the relationship, because Spiegelman's father remarried, and the relationship he had with her, the second wife, it was just, you know, it almost seemed like, you know, she was almost like a caretaker, and he was like, you know, not, he was treating her like garbage in a lot of different ways. And, but that was, you know, his attitude, you know, you're not my wife, you're my first love and everything. You're just the person I'm with now, or type thing. You were just living together. And I've seen that in real life relationships, you know, with older people who, you know, they get married just out of convenience instead of, you know, because they were in love.
Right. Because he didn't want to be alone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
I do think Art portrays himself the worst in this book, though. If you're looking at a character that the most of the time where I was like, God, I just hate you. It's Art. I mean, he comes in with, you know, hating his dad, hating his mom, hating that his mom committed suicide, not really knowing how to deal with it. He's got this French, you know, girlfriend, wife, and she seems fine, but she keeps putting across all these normal suggestions. And he's like, God, no, why would we ever do any of that? I'm like, man, you just, like, it's funny because his father's telling the story about taking care of people and doing whatever you have to do to make sure that your family survives and doing whatever you have to do to make sure that, you know, a true version of survival, but not just for him. You know, he did anything he could to make sure that Anya survived or that his friends survived or the people that had his back survived. And you know, meanwhile, here's Art, his very privileged son, who knows he's privileged, but like can't fathom the idea of having his father, who's at the end of his life, live with him. And I'm just like, man, you're not a good human. And that's okay. I think you know that. But he was just hard for me to read.
Yeah, well, he doesn't shy. Yeah, you're right. I mean, he doesn't shy away from portraying that.
No,
at all.
I mean, he has. I mean, obviously. I mean, and he has a lot of, you know, guilt issues, and he's pretty clear about those as well. But yeah, and I look. I mean, that's the beauty of him. None of these characters are, you know, flat. None of these are one dimensional characters. There are all times where you can't stand any of them, and then there are times when you feel so bad for all of them. It's one of those situations where, yeah, there's that, but that makes them human, and that's important for a story like this because of the things that humans are doing to one another on a grand scale as well as on a personal scale.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very much so. Because if you think about it, you know, the way they portrayed it and how he broke the books up, because he ended the first book right before the concentration camps and everything. And, you know, the first book ended with him saying under his breath, I hate you, to his father.
And murderer? Is that what he's saying?
Yeah, called a murderer. Called a murderer.
Yeah.
And it was just like, you know, how powerful is that? And, you know, it was just, and then you had to wait at the time for the second book to come out, which was at least, I think, a year and a half later.
Well, you could have subscribed to Raw.
Yeah. I could have, but you know. But
if you were waiting, that was on you, man.
Yeah. But you know, Art Spiegelman, literally, he has the notoriety of being the first graphic novel to win the Pulitzer.
Yeah.
The graphic novel had been around for a while. I mean, obviously, the comic form had been around for, you know, 70 years or so, but it wasn't until, you know, this that I think people realized, wow, this is some serious stuff, you know.
Yeah.
It took that long for it to be. I mean, Will Eisner kind of quote unquote created the graphic novel, and his work is outstanding as well. But really, this was something that this was something different, and that's why more than anything else that I always wanted to, you know, it was one of those things that I wanted to read. I always knew though that as much as I wanted to read it at some point, I knew it wasn't going to be an easy read. You know, it's like one of those things like, oh, you want to sit around and watch, you know, Schindler's List tonight? No, I don't want to do that tonight because that's going to be kind of heavy. You know, like it's just, you know, it's a great movie, but it's going to be kind of heavy. So it's one of those things. It's like, oh, do you want to read Mouse? I'd rather, you know, deal with some other stuff. But I think it's important. And I understand now that this is required reading in a lot of schools, in a lot of areas, a lot of programs. And I applaud that. That's awesome.
I know at Williams School, it is required reading now. And it was just, it actually floored me when he says, Dad, do you have a copy of Mouse? It's like, why? And he says, oh, we're doing it in a literature class. And it's like, really? And so I said, of course.
Doing a graphic novel literature class?
Exactly. Are you sure you don't want to do Watchmen instead? Come on.
Yes, they're sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was really amazing. And I am so glad it's gotten that kind of notoriety because it is so worth it.
I think it goes to show how strong, I mean, I've always been a huge proponent of how strong the comic medium is. And we get stuck, you know, because of tradition, we get stuck thinking it's just about superheroes beating each other in the face. And it's not, it doesn't have to be. I mean, that's one element, which is really cool when it's done well, but there's so much more. And, you know, I think Spiegelman's one of those guys that can take the underground movement, the comic strip movement, the comic book movement, the graphic novel format, and combine it all into this particular work, which I think it makes it brilliant as well. I mean, he's using all the tools. He's using the same tools that, you know, that Bob Kane used. He's using the same tools that Charles Schulz used. You know, I mean, people think that they're different, but the medium is really similar. He's using the same tools that, you know, Robert Crumb used. I mean, he's pulling everything into this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very
he's
much
He's using
so.
The same tools that Walt Disney used, you know?
Yeah, well, literally. Yeah, it's all in the way that he's telling the story that makes the difference. And this is Mouse led to kind of a renaissance in graphic novels. I mean, yeah. we've had some incredible graphic novels come out in the years since then. And the one that I always think of in comparison with Mouse is Fun Home by Alison Bechdel, who it is also a story about a child coming to grips with her parents and one of them who committed suicide. And I'm not sure that novel would have happened without Mouse. You know, it kind of gave everyone permission to tell these stories in this new way.
I've never heard that. What is it called again?
Fun Home.
Fun Home, yeah.
Fun Home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was turned into a Broadway show, by the way.
Oh.
And won the Tony for best, I think it was best musical.
Mm-hmm. The book I always compare Mouse to, or not compare, but I lump in with Mouse is It's a Bird by Steven Siegel, art by Teddy Christensen, I think is how you actually pronounce that.
Mm-hmm.
It's another biographical about a comic book writer's attempt to write Superman while he is dealing with his family's Huntington's disease. It's a really emotional book. It actually has that Jewish crossover because of course, Superman's history. But it definitely deals a lot with just that very personal storytelling, which if you've not read that book either, it was released, I think, by Vertigo, and it's really great.
Yeah. I'm familiar with Steven. He's a good writer. Very good. And yes, you're like the thing, like we talked about Neil Gaiman earlier, but I mean, Vertigo might not be around if, you know, Mouse hadn't been as successful as it was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it definitely let that charge into, hey, you know, take this more seriously. I mean, you might look at the cover and see this sort of, you know, Hitler faced cat, you know, and some mice there and think this is a satire. This is kind of going to be like this fun, dopey satire, like The Great Dictator in comic form or something. But it's not. It's not at all. And, I was sort of blown away by the artistry and the mastermanship of this. As opposed, like I said, the story is really, brutally intense as well. The way that it's told, because, I mean, there's only so much of that you could take, right? Like, if this was just if he cut out all the stuff between, you know, his father and him, and just told the story of his dad during the Holocaust, and not knowing like what happens, that would be a pretty brutal and intense tale in and of itself. But he kind of balances it out by giving us these moments with these family moments that are taking place in the quote unquote present at the time when he was doing this, as well as the fact that we know right from the beginning that his parents survive. So as bad as it gets, we kind of hold on to that. We keep holding on to that as bad as it gets because we know that they're going to survive. And that helps us through it, which is not to say that it lessens the intensity or the horror of what's going on. But
it takes away the thrill. Like, it's not a thriller book because of
exactly
that. Like, if you didn't know that ahead of time, this might be a thriller, but it's not.
That's not the point of this. This book is not to thrill you. It's not to scare you. Obviously, there's horrific things that are in this that are not in any other horror movie. You know,
I mean, chapter the image that buffers chapter two of the second book. The Auschwitz Time Flies chapter, which, by the way, might be my favorite chapter of all of them, even though I prefer book one to book two, which I don't think is that irregular. I think Time Flies chapter two is just brilliant, how it begins, how it ends. I mean, it's the chapter that is discussing the gas chambers, and some of the imagery in this is truly...
It's horrifying.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
But the end, when he's killing the flies with the gas can, like, just it, like that we use these things every day that was used to mass wipe out millions upon millions of people. I just think it's a really great chapter.
No, it's the whole two books, and I think now they have them combined into one, because I think, Mike, that's how you picked it up.
Yeah, I picked up the 25th, 25 years, people. picked up, and that was a few years ago that this came out, but it's the 25th anniversary volume is really good. It's a very nice paper, nice stock. It's a really good edition. I don't know if there's been a better release of it since then, even though it's been quite a few years since the 25th anniversary. But I definitely recommend people pick that up because it's a really great volume.
And it's helpful. It has maps.
Yes.
Maps are always helpful in stories like this.
So you actually know where this is all taking place, that these are actual places. Nothing in this book is fictional, folks.
Right.
You know, all this happened, you know, really in Poland, in Germany, in, you know, Eastern Europe. And, you know, these were all, you know, the concentration camps they go to, the internment camps, the towns, all this is real stuff. Some of these towns don't exist anymore. That's a whole different story.
There's a funny line in the I saw online. Spielberg wanted the New York Times to put this in the nonfiction section. And the editor of the New York Times responded, "Let's go to Spiegelman's house, and if a giant mouse answers the door, then we'll move it to the nonfiction side of the list."
Yeah, but that's a spurious argument. That really has nothing to do with it.
I agree.
Because he's using metaphor to tell the story doesn't mean that it's still nonfiction. It's the story that's nonfiction.
Exactly. If this wasn't a graphic novel, they never say, "Hey, I'm a mouse. Hey, I'm a pig. Hey, I'm a reindeer." Although, how cute was it that the Swedes were reindeers? They never said, I don't know why that tickled me.
In fact, they talk about mice and rats in, like, they're like, they encounter mice.
There's like actually rats, like in a bunker that they had, like, not anthropomorphic rats, real rats. Yeah, there's actual animals in with, like, they talk about dogs, but then the Americans are dogs. Like, at no point are, you know, the Americans actually thought of as dogs, a different race. It's just used, like you said, as a metaphor to visualize different nationalities and different groups of people.
Right.
They're never talked about that way, though. And I totally agree. I think this absolutely should be considered a nonfiction.
Well, for those who haven't read the book yet, what are the different nationalities and how they're represented?
Okay, so yeah, Jews are mice. Germans are cats. Americans are dogs. The Poles are
pigs.
Pigs.
The poor Poles. I'm like, that's the worst one for me. I'm like, wow, that's ouch.
Well, there's a rough history there.
I get it. I know why, but it's just like, it's like, oh, that, you know, when you see it on paper, it's like, okay.
The Swedes are reindeer. The Gypsies are moss. I think specifically lunar moss, but I would have to do research to look that up. And the French are frogs. There's only one though, so.
Yeah.
Did I miss any?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No, you did.
No, it's pretty simple. They're pretty, you know, pretty straightforward.
Yeah, you can't mix them up.
I don't know what he would have done if he met some, you know, an Asian.
I mean, why do you think those were the animals though? Like, if we want to get deep into symbolism and
I think it's because if you strip them down, our culture has certain emotional connotations about those animals, about, you know, the whole thing about mice and cats is prey and predator.
Yeah,
cats are seen as manipulative and cruel and playing with the things that they are going to kill.
And it actually
pigs are brutish and bullies, even though they're not really. Right. But in our culture, the emotional connotation is that.
And then the dogs, because, you know, they were the rescuers. The dogs are loyal. Right. They came in and saved the day.
The dogs are what, you know, the enemy of the cats.
Exactly. So what do you think? Where do you think he started? Do you think he started with Germans as cats, or do you think he started off with like Jews as mice? Because like beyond this, like, The connotation of mice isn't good. You know, it is this vermin, which, I mean, do you guys get this in your editions? Actually, this is a good question. Did you get the quote about Walt Disney in your versions of book two?
Yes. The one where, she says something about, or he says something about Walt Disney. He's like,
in the beginning of, so in the 25 year comp, in the 25th edition, right before book two, it has this quote from a newspaper article that ran in Germany in the mid-1930s, and it says, "Mickey Mouse is the most miserable ideal ever revealed. Healthy emotions tell every independent young man and every honorable youth that the dirty and filth-covered vermin, the greatest bacteria carrier in the animal kingdom, cannot be the ideal type of animal. Away with the Jewish brutalization of the people, down with Mickey Mouse, wear the swastika cross." And that was a quote from a newspaper article in Germany. Sorry about that so poorly. But do you think that inspired, I guess I should have done research before I did this, but you know, you think of mice as somewhat what they say here, vermin, but like at the same time, crafty, very able to hide places, you know, all the bunkers you see in the novel are usually underground, or up in an attic, you know, places where mice might hide. I just thought it was a very smart choice, but also I thought that quote was really, telling. Just wondering what y'all thought.
Well, I think he's playing with perception in the story, because it depends on how you, what these animals are to you depends on how you perceive them. And Hitler and the Nazis referred to the Jews multiple times, the Jewish people multiple times as vermin. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not surprised that he used cats and mice in that way, but he shows that the way that, even though the Germans view them that way, that's not what they are at all. I mean, these people did everything they could to survive, and a lot of them didn't, but that had nothing to do with the fact that, you know, they weren't incredible human beings just because the Germans didn't see them that way. So, I mean, playing with perception is a great way to tell a story and to lead people into thinking of things in a different way.
And because he was a underground artist for years, I mean, I think his first published work was when he was a teenager. So, I mean, he was working anti sort of establishment for so long, telling personal stories that for a lot of them in the underground movement, the iconic Mickey Mouse and Walt Disney was a symbol to sort of undermine and make fun of. And in that first, and it definitely is intentional because with the Mickey Mouse, because in the first 3-page thing that he did in 1972, you know, it sets up where in the beginning, it starts with an older mouse with his son telling a story of the camps before bedtime. And the last panel, the father says, I can't tell you no more. It's time to go to sleep, Mickey. I mean, he calls him Mickey.
I noticed that.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's right there, like right from the beginning.
That's good. That's really good.
Well, if you think about it, though, also think about the opening vignette in the book where, you know, Art Spiegelman's character is back in 1958 and he's playing with his friends and his roller skate gives out. And the other kids run off on him, and and he comes crying to his father and says, my friends left me. He says, oh, friends, you don't know what it is to have real friends. And it's just, it's so.
So you're locked in locked into a room for days without food and water. Then you know what friends are.
Exactly. Yeah. It's just amazing. And it catches you right from there. And this is not light reading. You can't just read this in one day. It's tough if you do.
I was going to say,
yeah,
I would
it's
not,
pretty devastating.
As much as it's cool, it's like, yeah, this is not, you know, it's not in some ways the way he's telling the story. And, you know, like, because you know that they survive, you're kind of like, you want to keep going. It is kind of like hard to put down. But there are times when you're like, I really need to step away from this for a little while because it is pretty intense.
It's this large scale. I think another reason why it's so powerful is it's a very large scale story in the sense that the Holocaust is this large scale historical event, but he's telling it through these small scale human scenes. And so it just really brings it home to you. I mean, you can't shy away from it. I mean, it's one of the reasons why it's hard to sit there and read it all the way through, because you feel like you're right there. Because you've experienced some of these things yourself in your own human experience. And I mean, I think it's probably the first graphic novel. I mean, I read a lot of comics and stuff, seen a lot of artwork, and this is the first time I just could not stop crying by the end of the book.
Oh, God.
This is like, oh.
There's some teary eyed moments for me in this, too. I mean, it's pretty brutal, like some of it, especially what happens to the young son. I mean, that's tough.
Oh,
that's...
when the aunt Cersei Lannisters.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
I was like, oh, she's wearing poison around her neck. I was like, okay. No, that was terrible. But I think, I mean, a lot of people took that choice.
Oh, sure. And,
it's
you know
an
what?
Understandable choice.
I was going to say,
is. It's completely
I'm not saying,
understandable.
Exactly. It definitely. Like, I have no idea how I would react in this situation. I can only hope that I would be as strong as Vladek in some ways, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, it's interesting to watch his struggle. And despite the fact that he is a survivor, growing up and Mary said something about like how this book is important so that, you know, people don't repeat this sort of thing. Well, the seeds of it are right at the end of this book. I mean, the way Vladek treats the African-American, the black hitchhiker, is like, my God, you know, you would think that, you know, like that that's not acceptable.
Oh,
right?
And I mean, especially since there are so many images of this book as an American growing up that I'm much more used to seeing it from the black perspective, like the lynchings and the beatings and the hangings that happen in this book. I'm much more, just used to seeing it from that perspective, seeing it in this context. It is, You know, but yeah, you're like, history's repeating itself. Well, but that being said, that is just one person. Jews did a lot during the civil rights movement, and I don't want to discredit that. But no, it's true. If you don't learn from your own experiences and you can't connect to people and empathically a little bit, or at least like, I don't know, relate to the human condition in everybody. We're seeing it now. I mean, I hate to get political. I don't actually. I don't hate to get political. I just know we shouldn't be getting political in this podcast. But, you know, you see it now. You know, people just don't relate to other people as people. Right. You know, grouping people together is not new, and it is certainly never anything that's gone away.
Well, exactly. I know, but a lot of it is, if you have a friend who just happens to be part of that other group, oh, I don't include you into that. You're not really like that. And that's,
yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, we say like, oh, well, especially in this current climate, there hasn't been a climate that this couldn't happen. Like,
right.
There hasn't been a climate since humans like first, you know, came out of their caves where this couldn't happen. Like, this is like, certainly
or
in
that
my
didn't
lifetime,
happen. This has certainly happened before, you know, like the Holocaust is not the first Holocaust.
No, it's not the first Holocaust, but it isn't the last one either. There has been over the last 70 years, other Holocausts, not as wide, well known, but there's been Holocausts in Eastern Europe. There's been Holocausts in Africa, you know, Asia, you know, there's
not,
been,
I mean, let's be real, not as well planned.
Well, no.
Not as systematic.
But that doesn't matter. No, I'm not saying that matters.
No,
I'm
exactly.
just saying that's why it's not at, it's not the one people remember it off the bat. But no, absolutely. You know, you look at, the Armenians, you look at, there's hundreds.
The Cambodians, the Rwandans, you know, you can go on and on. Genocide has never stopped.
I mean, genocide.
Between World War II and now, there have been several instances of genocide.
Absolutely. I mean, and we're ignoring today all the genocide that's happening in countries by their own leaders. We ignore North Korea, you know, we pretty much ignore Syria. I mean, that's a little bit, but you know, we ignore all of those instances and just say, well, if it's happening in those borders, I guess we don't need to be getting involved.
And I think, well, to my point though, is I think that, you know, I think that gives you some indication as to why, like, cause this isn't, you don't see this from the Germans' point of view. So you don't know like how you're left to wonder in some ways until that moment in the car, you're left to wonder like, how could people do this to other people? Cause it's not going to like, this is not going to explore that. Right. Because in this, it's like, you know, the Nazis are just bad and evil. That's why they're doing this. There's no justification. Obviously there's no understanding. There's nothing from their perspective. So they're just mean old cats. But until that incident in the car, all of a sudden there's that seed where you're like, oh, well, this might be how it kind of starts. And that to me was a big moment. At least although I will say, and I don't know how you guys felt about this either, but I was struck by the suddenness of the ending. Like it almost seemed like I'm done. Boom. Like I thought that there would be like, I don't know. I thought that I was kind of hoping there would not a happy ending for sure, but just something that was a little like, it seemed really sudden to me. Did you guys feel that too? Or
it was a little abrupt.
It ends with them finding each other.
Well, yeah, no, but I mean, maybe the very end,
it is a
like the
sappy
last page.
End.
Right. Right.
You know, it is, you do get as happy of an ending as you're going to get considering this is a true story. And right. this woman kills herself.
Right, and you know what happens later. Right. And
yeah.
They give birth to a, you know, privileged spoiled son. Right. Yes,
right. Right. But you end the story with him finding her and him wanting to stop talking at that point because that's the best part for him.
Yeah.
And I got emotional. Like, I mean, their love.
as horrifying as everything that happened to his father is, in some ways, you'd be hard pressed to think of. I mean, Art was, God, I hate to use the word fortunate, but it's certainly fortuitous to have a father that went through like as much that the whole experience as he did. You know what I mean? Like, it's just this well-rounded from start to finish experience, which, you know, a lot of survivors weren't lucky to have.
Yeah. No, exactly. And this
and the fact that they, you know, like, if I didn't know that this was based on a true story, I was finding it very difficult to believe that he would have been reunited with his wife. I just was like, I just don't know how that would have been possible.
I mean, you know, not saying it happened a lot, but actually, if you, I mean, you know, having being Jewish, I probably listened to at least 24 survivor stories at this point in my life personally. You just get around it a lot, you know. Jewish community centers will bring people in and talk to you when you're younger and all that sort of stuff. That all happens. But I actually think it's so important. If you've never taken the time to like really listen to a few survivor stories, everyone's stories are heartbreaking and phenomenal in their own way. I know women who ended up marrying the American man that rescued them. Like, I mean, there's some just really beautiful things that came out of terrible tragedies.
Oh, very much so.
When you listen to survivors, I mean, this is one survivor story where I don't think he came out of it quite, you know, like I said in the beginning, there's no one way to deal with tragedy. But some survivors come out of it with this real lease on life that's very beautiful. And I think all of these stories are really precious.
Well, you know, I have relatives of mine who actually, they thought each other were dead during the Holocaust. And they both remarried because they thought their spouses were dead. And, you know, they came, both of them separately came to the United States, and they found each other again 20 years later. And they it was an interesting situation. It was a situation where, you know, they had fallen in love with other people, and but their first loves were, you know, still alive, but they had children and families with other people now. And so they remained close, but they couldn't, you know, they didn't.
Oh my gosh.
You know, so there's stories of that happened. Yeah. And 'cause, you know, when they went to the concentration camps, you know, the men were separated from the women. The men were, mm-hmm. a lot of times were either sent to the gas chambers or they were sent into labor. And a lot of times the women, the same thing, were something even worse what happened to the women. You know, it just all depended, you know, on the camp that they were at, and they were separated. And, you know, I knew both of them, and I had, you know, the story, you know, of the family was that, you know, this was the story, you know, we knew the stories of what happened, and I knew them both as, you know, Uncle Saul and Aunt Millie, and that they were married once, but they were married to, you know, Ida and Joe, you know, so with other people. So it was just because I had cousins with them, and, you know, of course, but it was interesting stories, and there's tons of stories like that, or even, you know, even more complicated, you know. So it's amazing that he was able to find his wife out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole story is amazing. The fortune. I mean, obviously he did what he could to at the right time, the right place. He did the right thing, to go on to the next thing, you know? But I mean, I think in the book it mentions like it didn't matter if you were handsome or good looking. It didn't matter if you, what skills you had. It really just, I mean, it did come down to luck a lot of times.
Oh, very much so. And
luck and chutzpah.
Well, yeah. And it was interesting. I don't know, especially, you know, Tara, you know, when you were reading it, whose voice did you hear in your head?
I heard the old man's voice.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Most of the time.
But I heard it in a Polish accent because my grandfather was, and grandparents were Polish. And so I heard it in that, in my grandfather's voice, reading it. You know, Art Spiegelman's, you know, voice was just an American, but when the...
An American voice.
Yeah, but when it was, he was doing the flashbacks or when he was, the father was talking, it was always my grandfather's voice.
Yeah, no, I absolutely, so neither of my grandparents are, they both have American accents, but I definitely heard, I know that accent, you know, I know that accent. That is the accent I, I heard when
exactly,
I was reading.
Like the Yiddish type Polish voice. And that's what I was hearing the voice in my head. And it was almost freaky to hear that. And especially this time, because, you know, I hadn't read the book probably in at least 15 years. And, you know, getting ready for this, it was just like hearing it and literally from the first page reading it on. And when he spoke, it was my grandfather's voice in my head. It was just like, wow. And that's what even moved it even more.
Yeah, that's a very cool experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, probably a very emotional experience for you, though.
Oh, it was. And this whole book is an emotional experience, you know. And, you know, for folks out there, if you want to learn more about the Holocaust and survivor stories, if you ever get a chance, ever, 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 go to the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. They have an amazing Holocaust museum there.
Oh, yeah. It's actually, it's not a Smithsonian. It's not a Smithsonian, but it is like, if you can't go to Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Museum in Israel, it is the next best thing.
It is
beautiful. And they do have this collection of stories, you know, where they really, you know, the thing you say is never forget, right?
Exactly.
And they really make that their mission in a beautiful, beautiful way.
Exactly. And it's going to be the most reading you've ever done in a museum.
That's true, too.
And, you know, and Mouse is represented at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely, you know, it is truly, folks, you know, there's a lot of resources out there. Most major cities do have Holocaust memorials or museums, and they are all worth checking out.
And same thing, most major cities have Jewish community centers, and they're not just for Jewish people, and they have tons of programs and a lot of materials as well.
Exactly. So, you know, definitely worth checking out. And we do have links on our ESO Amazon store for Mouse. We have the 25th anniversary, and it was interesting. I also found up there on Amazon a book that is talking about the about, you know, Mouse itself, but it was called Meta Mouse. It's a look at the modern classic. It's by also by Art Spiegelman. It's a lot of backstory and a lot of what he went into. It's pretty cool.
I like the title.
Mm-hmm. So it's definitely worth taking a peek at, and, you know, we definitely want to hear from you guys at home. What did you guys think of this book? You know, did you guys read along or have you read it? You know, it's definitely.
Did you cry?
Did you laugh? Did you cry? Well, I don't think many people laughed.
There are some amusing bits in here, but I see what you're saying. Yes. If this should be, this should almost be like one of those litmus test books where if you give a kid Mouse, you know, and how he reacts or how she reacts is like really, like whether or not they, how much more, you know, psychological help they're going to need.
Yeah. Touche, my friend. Touche.
If they laugh, they're a serial killer.
Yeah. If they're like, yeah, if they're looking at this as like thinking, you know, this is a how to do book or something like that, then yeah, that kid needs to be sanctioned off. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And check your yard for fresh animal graves.
Ooh, don't yes.
be very Absolutely. Concerned.
Mr. Lecter, put the book down. It's okay.
But yeah, definitely a classic, and I definitely recommend, I can't recommend this highly enough. I mean, in terms of graphic novels, it's truly one of the best I've ever read. As far as Holocaust stories, I mean, it's right there with, you know, as far as medium, other mediums go, Diary of Anne Frank, or or Schindler's List as far as like classic like treatment mm-hmm. of this story, of this event, you know. Mm-hmm. It's right there. It belongs right alongside those. And in some cases, it even surpasses those in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And there are quite a few movies out there about the Holocaust.
Sure.
And tons of books. And so, you know, definitely, you know, but this is a great place if you've never read anything about it to start it up.
But it's also, like I said, I want to make sure that, you know, I mean, yes, it's like the subject matter is really important. But yes, as just a graphic novel, if you want to read from a master like what this medium can do, then there's no better example I can think of in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not sure I've ever read anything that connects word with art in the same way that this does. I mean, it just flows seamlessly it's hard to imagine this without the artwork and similarly without the text. They are so married together perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's another aspect of this book, too, is I'm sure that it brought in a whole new audience for this kind of history and story, simply because it was an experimental graphic novel. And so it just reached a different group of people.
And that's exactly. Coming from me, too, who like was like looking at it like this is a classic. I've been told over and over again for decades that this is a classic. You should read it. You should read it. So now I've got my expectations. So right from the first page, I'm like, all right, impress me. And damn it, if it did.
Well, we definitely, you know, highly recommend this. Please take a peek at this one. We already have our next book scheduled. We are going to be coming back. I think we're going to be back in June with our next edition of the book club. And we are going to be looking at Watchmen. We actually talked about that real briefly earlier. And, you know, a lot of different things are going on in the DC universe that are starting to tie into Watchmen. And it's that, again, is not a happy-go-lucky tale. What is this with book clubs and us not doing, you know, happy books or something? I think the next time we might have to do a Garfield book or something.
Oh, no.
So I hope it's early Garfield.
Yeah, that's when you really find out how he hates Mondays. It's okay. So with that being said, we'll be back in a second. Up next is Angela, and then we will be back with the Con Report.
All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out
places. Welcome to A Geek Girl's Take. I'm your host, Angela, and this week, this geek girl is talking about the television show Legion. Now, I know I'm a little late to the game since I just started watching Legion and was incredibly intrigued the second I heard about a show based off of an X-Men character that not everyone may know about. I was really interested in seeing how a show that almost to me seemed to be in the same maturity level as the Netflix shows was going to go based off of a mutant that, again, not everyone is familiar with. First off, this show is trippy. There are so many weird cutscenes that you don't know what's going on in the main character's head and what's happening in the actual real time of the show. So, it's a weird watch. Second, oh my god, the first, like, second that I saw the yellow-eyed demon, I was like, holy crap, is that Mojo? Which I kind of hope we find out eventually, because that would be really, really cool, no matter if it's Mojo or some character made up for this show, since most of the characters outside of the main one, Legion, are all made specifically for this series. They're not, right now, Marvel characters. Overall, this is a very unconventional Marvel show. If you like weird shows that happen to have mutants in them, but are not in the same line as the Marvel Comics movies where they're slightly more lighthearted, then watch this show. It has great acting, weird storylines, and even some Bollywood dancing going on. Well, thanks for listening to A Geek Girl's Take. What will I talk about next week? Well, you're going to have to listen to find out.
No one knew me. Hello, teacher, tell me what's my lesson. Look right through me.
Welcome back. Now it's time for the ESO Con Report.
Well, last weekend, we had one of probably our favorite times. We went to one of our favorite conventions that is on our schedule. Not to say that there are not all are not cool in their own way. But there's something about the South Carolina Comic-Con in Greenville, South Carolina, that is just special. We were there last weekend, Mike, myself, and a lot of friends of the station. Artist Peter Cutler was there, as well as artist and creator Randy Bishop, Anthony Taylor, Bobby Nash, the award-winning Bobby Nash.
Mike, did we let him out of the airlock?
And Bobby?
Yeah, Bobby.
And Bobby's been out of the airlock. He's no JD, man. I mean, I think he lives in the escape pods. So he knows the difference now. No, lots of other friends as well. It's just of course, we need to thank first and foremost, the organizer of the show, the master of masters, Robert Young, who also runs Borderlands Comics and Games in Greenville, South Carolina, and his lovely wife, Michelle. I think it starts at the top. They treat this like a family event, like much like you would like a family barbecue or something. And they just make it special. And it has a family feel to it. Obviously it's children there. It's family friendly. There's children all over the place. But the whole community comes out for this. There's thousands and thousands of people. And people don't travel from miles around to come to this show. I mean, some do, but most of the people that are at this show are locals. Because they're familiar with Robert's store, because they're familiar with what he does in the community. And now because this is the fourth year for the South Carolina Comic-Con, and it's getting bigger and better every year. In addition to ourselves being there, they had some great guests. And I actually got to meet one of my heroes. So it was a personal checklist off the whole bucket list for me. A check off the old bucket list. Was that something like that? Anyway. I got to meet creator Denny O'Neill. We talked a little bit about writing comics, which to me was a dream come true. It was great to meet Denny. I also met Mike Zeck and Neil Adams and Mark Wade was there. Talked to a lot of other creators. It's just a great environment, and it really is focused on comics. I mean, there's a lot of costuming. There's a lot of cosplay, a lot of folks in costume. Our good friends Miracle and Chris Burns are there in costume and representing. Lacey, our sometimes co-host, was there and met her for the first time. Great, great time. I could go on and on, Mike, obviously, but
really?
You had a good time. I understand you had a good time this weekend, too.
It was an okay time. In all truth, folks, this is my favorite true Comic-Con of the year. Like Mike said, we go to other Comic-Cons and we have great times, but there's something special about the show that Robert puts on. It's like nothing else. The feel, the look, the atmosphere, the people in Greenville are just so welcoming. And Robert and his crew, make you feel special if you're a vendor, if you're a guest, or you're just showing up to actually come to the con. It is a true event, and it gets bigger and better every single year.
Absolutely. Any personal highlights for you over the weekend? Either costume you saw, a person you met, anything like that?
Well, we met a lot of friends of the show, and, we've had people walking by. Oh, ESO, I know you guys. It was even more apparent at this show this year, and it was great to, meet, our friend Raven was there. We met Tina from the ESO Facebook page. We met her in person.
Shout out howdy to Tina. Yes, that was great fun. I did not expect her to be there. That was a surprise.
No, and Lacey was great. She hung out at our table for quite a bit, and me and her went hunting for pop figures together, and it was great.
Right on. Right on, right on.
Exactly. And so, it was fun. And, I just had a great time. I'm already looking forward to next year's. So, bring it on. I'm looking forward to seeing what Robert comes up for next time.
Yeah, it's they've already announced the dates for next year, and it will be at the end of March again. So mark your calendars because you'll want to make a trip for this one. This one. I was not around doing conventions locally here or on the East Coast
for the early days of Heroes, but from those people who were and have been to South Carolina Con, they tell me that it's very much like Heroes was in the beginning, the early days of Heroes. And Heroes is one of the best comic shows that anybody you'll ever go to. It's fantastic. So it's in good company. I definitely recommend it. So, and both Mike and I took a lot of pictures. So please go to the ESO Facebook group, seek us out, click on our names, look at our albums. And we have, tens and tens and tens of pictures that we took of the event, because there's always somebody walking right in costume, and they're great costumes over there. So it's a lot of things to take pictures of. And so hopefully you'll see that that's living proof that we had a great time. So now some shows that are coming up that you can find ESO personnel starting now. We're in April. Can you believe we're in April already, Mike? It's just like, man, this year is flying by.
Time is flying before you even know it. Before you could say Olive Abgam and 10 times backwards.
Easy for you to say.
Exactly. And if you say it 10 times backwards, you'll be at Dragon Con.
Well, it's... Dragon Con's still a ways, and we've got a lot of conventions between now and then, starting with next weekend, April 13th through the 16th. It is Frolicon. And I understand, Mike, you will be there at least for a day checking out that show. Now, for those people who are not familiar with Frolicon, you'll definitely want to go to the website and check out. Unlike the South Carolina Comic Con, it is not a family-friendly event. It is very much an adult event. You'll want to check it out and see if it is a con for you. We had some great discussions with the organizers a few weeks ago. So you might want to rewind one of our past episodes so you can listen to that interview. Great fun. Sounds like a great time, Mike.
Oh, definitely. And we have a lot of friends of the show who are going to be there. But remember, folks, it is a 21 plus con.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then a couple weeks after that, right here in Atlanta, Georgia, is Treklanta. And that is the local Trek-centric convention that's here. It's April 28th through the 29th. Very excited because two guests that are going to be there, besides Mike and myself. Of course, I'm excited because Mike and myself are going to be there. And we'll be doing a panel on Saturday called What We Learned from Star Trek. And we'll be recording that panel for to air as an episode of Earth Station 1. So if you want to be on the show and you want your voice heard about what you learned for the 50-year franchise, please come to the panel at Treklanta on Saturday. But they've got a couple of other great guests, too, including J.G. Herzler, who was Klingon Martok there. He's one of my favorites from Deep Space Nine. He's done a lot of other stuff as well. And friend of the station. I think it's fair to call him a friend of the station. He hasn't been on the station in a long time, but he was in the geek seat. Actually, parts of him still might be in the geek seat. Writer, the award-winning writer, David Gerald, who has written The Trial, The Trouble with Tribbles, as well as other Star Trek episodes and stories. He'll be there as well. I'm looking forward to meeting him. I've actually never met him in person, so very excited for that. Tons of other friends of the station are going to be there. If you like Star Trek, if you like having a good time, you'll want to come to Treklanta. That, again, is April 28th through the 30th. It's in a new location this year, so people should know that. It's at the Doubletree by Hilton Atlanta at North Lake Hotel. So make a note of that. And as always, there will be show notes. There will be links to that convention in the show notes. So that same weekend in Williamsburg, Virginia, is RavenCon. And our own Angela, geek girl herself, will be there. And that's happening in Williamsburg. And that's the only ones in April. In May, we've got another one of our favorite conventions. And that is Hoolanta. Yes, it's Timegate with a new name. And a new date. Usually Timegate takes place in Memorial Day weekend. But Hoolanta is going to be at the beginning of May. It's May 5th through the 7th. It's at the same location, which is at the Marriott Century Center. And it's a great hotel. We're there a lot for conventions. We're very excited because it's our hometown show. It's our hometown Hoolanta show. And the crew from Earth Station Who, at least myself and Mike and Jen, will be there. Unfortunately, Mary, who's on this episode, will not be able to come to Hoolanta. But maybe one year we'll be able to get her out. But for now, we'll just have to settle for her being at Dragon Con. And also, Geek Girl Angela Pritchett will be there. And I'm sure you can talk to her in addition to her Geek Girl segments that she does for ESO. You can talk to her about playing the ukulele, and you can talk to her about her Doctor Who-related recipe book. So it'll be great to see Angela again. It's a great show, and we are very much looking forward to it. We look forward to all the conventions that we're going to be at. We're very excited. We can't thank you guys enough, organizers like Robert, to invite us to be part of the conventions. We love talking about conventions. We love promoting them. So if you've got a convention that you want us to help out with, please feel free to contact.
All right, 3, 2. So that's going to wrap up another episode of the Earth Station 1 podcast. I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. Of course, let's thank our guests. Tara, thank you so much for being here.
No problem. Thanks for having me again.
Hey, what is your podcast so people can find you guys?
Yeah, so, you know, if you liked what you guys do here and you want more bookish stuff, come and hang out with me and my three friends at Eclectic Readers. You can find us, just Google Eclectic Readers Podcast, and you'll find us basically everywhere where books are talked about or podcasts are listened to. So, yeah, come hang out.
Awesomeness. Excellent. And, of course, I've listened to her podcast since I found out about it, and it's a lot of fun. I've even gone back and listened to some of the old ones.
Yeah. Sorry about the audio. It's better now.
That's what they all say. You should hear
what we say.
That's what ESO says also, so it's okay. And of course, Mary.
And thank you for having me. It's Mouse is a fantastic book, and I loved talking about it. Thank you for letting me.
Hey, now you got to go back onto the Doctor Who side of the station.
Yep, now I have to walk all the way back to the other side of the station. It's probably going to take me about 2 weeks, and then I'll be there.
Big station.
It's a big station. We haven't even discovered half of it yet. We don't even know what's out there.
There are many stories to be told about it.
Oh, yeah. Maybe there'll be a book about it. You never know.
Maybe there will.
Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink. But anyway, do you have anything you want to shout out about, my dear?
I do, actually. I have just opened a store on Etsy. It has digital downloads. It has hand-painted scrapbook paper and clip art. And if you're a crafter, you're going to love it. A lot of my designs are up there. And so if you just search eVision Arts on Etsy, you'll find me.
That is awesome. And, you know, folks, if you haven't seen Mary's artwork, it is so spectacular. You're going to be so impressed when you see her stuff. She's done a couple versions of our logo for us, and she's, you know, currently working on some new projects for ESO and ESW, and we might even have a new store going up soon. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
What?
Yes. So pretty cool. So we might have some new stuff happening, and, you know, if I can ever get this website up and fully running again, I'll be able to put my attention to that. So with that, of course, we have my co-host to thank for this week. Mr. Mike, we made it through Greenville, and now we made it through another podcast.
We did. As always, it's my pleasure, sir.
Anything you're going to shout out about, sir?
I do. I want to give a shout out to, I already mentioned him a couple times in this podcast, but I want to give a shout out to the artist of Tiki Zombie, my good friend, Peter Cutler. Like I said, he was really a great resource to talk all about Art Spiegelman and about the history of Mouse. He has a couple of Spiegelman sketches in his collection as well, and he's met him a few times. So that was great to have that personal contact, as well as he's just a great artist. I mean, I'm constantly marveled at the sketches that he does while we're at the conventions. And he does really make my writing look a lot better after I hand him the script. So and he's now really more paying a lot more attention to Facebook. So if anybody wants to go check out his artwork, he's got some new stuff that he just put up there just today, as a matter of fact, from the convention. And he's paying attention. So if you want to reach out and get a piece of art from Peter Cutler yourself, please reach out to him in Facebook. I'll have the link on the show notes so you can say, hey, I want one of those.
Okay. That's awesome. Peter was every time I looked over at your table, there was a crowd of people around him. It's really awesome. Mm-hmm. I think the man is starting to glow. It's pretty awesome and grow and grow and grow. Peter is, you know, that's what attracted my eye to actually Tiki Zombie. The first time you showed me the cover, it was just like, wow. And I said, who did this? And he said, Peter did. And I was like, whoa. And he's just gotten even better since then.
So yeah, he's got a lot of roots in a sort of underground comic book making. So it's kind of nice to work with him on that level.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. All right. For me, I'm going to give a shout out to Beauty and the Beast for beating the Power Rangers at the movies this week. I just wanted to give him a congratulations. Haven't seen Beauty and the Beast yet. It was funny. Judy and I were supposed to go see it until she found out it was a musical. And she was like, what? It's like, and I said, honey, it's a remake basically of the Disney version. She was like, oh. And she said, I'm not going to that.
That was it.
She has no interest in it now.
So I just want to be clear. So you're giving a shout out to the mouse?
Yeah, I'm giving a shout out to the mouse. It goes with tonight's episode. What the heck?
On our mouse episode? Okay. I just wanted to make sure that's what you were doing.
Exactly. Beating those, you know, mean old Power Rangers out there, you know.
But I have heard great things about that movie. I have not seen it. I have heard great, great things.
Power Rangers or?
About the Power Rangers movie.
I've actually heard some good things about it too.
Yeah, I have too. But, you know, it's just interesting that, you know, it is, you know, I thought it would be the number one movie, but, you know, it's amazing that Beauty and the Beast is actually, you know, for a G-rated movie, it has truly, I think it's become the largest, behind Finding Dory, the largest grossing G-rated movie in history.
I mean, the original did win an Academy Award for Best Picture.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Wow.
It's a little beloved.
Kind of, sort of. So we definitely want to hear from you guys at home. You know, looking forward to hearing about everyone we met at South Carolina. We met quite a few folks out there. And we also met some friends of the show. We talked about that earlier. But, you know, we definitely want to hear from you. And if this is your first time listening to ESO, thank you. You know, our numbers just doubled. It's perfect with whoever we just met. So it's cool. So we definitely, you know, want to hear back from you. ESOpodcast@gmail.com. Or, of course, call us at 404-963-9057. And speaking of, like we were talking earlier about the movies, me and Mike are going back to the movies again next week. We are going to go see Ghost in the Shell. And interesting word buzz out there for this, and it's going to be interesting because this was a remake of anime, was it, Mike?
Yeah, there's an anime movie, Ghost in the Shell. It's also manga as well. To be honest, I'm not sure which came first. I think it was the motion picture, but I'm not sure. But anyway, it's very popular anime.
It's going to be interesting, and there was a controversy about, you know, the lead actress who was, you know, chosen for this, and, you know, how she was taken for it and how she was an Asian, kind of like with Iron Fist in some ways, tying into that. But we're not going into that right now, so we will talk all about it next week. Until then, my name is Mike Faber. We're looking forward to talking to you again and again and again and again. Until then, we will see you then. Peace. And we're done.
You've been listening to Earth Station 1, a weekly podcast that explores the many worlds of all things geek. Please write us at esopodcast@gmail.com or call us at 404-963-9057. And if we find what you say interesting, we'll put it up on the air. If you've enjoyed our show, please rate us or leave feedback for us up on iTunes. And while you're there, subscribe to our show or any of the ESO Network podcasts. We can also be found up on Stitcher Radio or wherever fine podcasts are found. ESO is also available up on most social media sites like Facebook, Twitter, and so many more. The show is brought to you by the fine folks at the ESO Amazon.com eStore, where right from our website you can find all kind of geeky goodness. And if you get something up there, you also help support the station. ESO also has a Zazzle store to buy cool ESO merchandise and such. Show your ESO love with something from Zazzle. To learn more about ESO, our website is esopodcast.com. The show is produced by Calico Productions. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you here next time on the Earth Station 1 podcast. Peace.
It's 106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark.
and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.